This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we will be looking back to the launch of the first human-made object to orbit the Earth, and that was Sputnik, which was launched in the fall of 19... No, I'm not even sure. I better not say the year because suddenly I'm blanking out on the year. But the man who knows is here on the telephone with us, and we'll be talking this morning. His name is Paul Dixon. He's an author, a journalist. He worked for many years for McGraw-Hill, but since 1968 has been a full-time freelance writer. He contributed articles to various magazines and papers, including Smithsonian, Esquire, The Nation, Town and Country, The New York Times, and others. And he has authored a new book. He's the author of more than 40, by the way. The new book, which is titled Sputnik Shock of the Century. It is published by... Well, I'm doing a great job here this morning. I can't even tell you who the publisher of the book, Walker and Company. It's a good thing this is the last show of the week. As we talk this morning, questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Any point here, you have questions, comments, so you can give us a call. Mr. Dixon, hello.
Yes, sir. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. I don't know why. 1957 is the year, and I know that I thought about the fact that when this happened, I was four. So I don't know why it is I couldn't summon that date up from my memory banks. Anyway.
You should be able to remember because that's what gave you all that homework.
I see. Well, obviously the science stuff didn't sink in because I'm a journalist and not a physicist today. Anyway, this was the fall of October 4th of 1957. And I guess I think for a lot of people today, as we are used to the idea of satellites, we have spy satellites and communication satellites and weather satellites and people in space and people have been to the moon. I think it's difficult perhaps for a lot of us to imagine the impact of the announcement that Sputnik had been launched and what that would have meant to people in 1957.
You're right. I mean, it was stupendous, and it was more than the announcement. The announcement was, still something almost like a press release from the Soviets. I mean, just a wire copy. But what really knocked people out was you could hear it. First of all, you could hear it. I mean, that night, I remember the night it went up. I was 19. So you can figure out the difference of our ages. But I was 19, and I was a freshman at Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut. And I was walking across the campus, and a friend of mine said, the Russians have just put something up in space. And, of course, we both instinctively looked up. But we ran back to the dorm, and we turned on the radio. And I'll never forget, the NBC guy said, it was network radio, and the guy said, listen now for the sound that will forevermore mark the difference between the old and the new. And then he starts playing this beeping sound. And we realized we were listening to a sound from space that was human, that was created by humans, rather. And so that was even more dramatic than anything, was hearing it. If you had a shortwave radio, you could get it as it went overhead. You would be sitting there, and it would go overhead, and you'd hear this beep, 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 beep across the sky. And you could and of course, the trump card in all of this was you could see it. And I saw it for the first time about a week after it went up. The conditions were perfect, and I walked out onto a football field with a lot of other people. We got an advance word about 20 minutes ahead of time that it was going to pass over the central Connecticut. And I went out there and saw it, and that's what was the stunning thing. It was just awesome because you realized, I mean, it was really like you were there for the first shot at Fort Sumter or the Battle of Hastings. I mean, you were seeing history with your own eyes, not filtered by television or anything else. You were actually seeing it, and it was quite dramatic. So it was more than just the announcement. It was that pomp, the audible and the visual that also contributed to it.
And as a piece of technology, Sputnik itself was basically just a metal sphere that had a transmitter in it, right?
Yeah, and it was not high tech. I mean, Korolev, the brilliant Russian scientist, who we didn't know about until after he was dead, but the guy who invented, basically created Sputnik, he was working with a slide rule. He had anything approximating a computer. It was fueled not by some sophisticated rocket fuel. It was fueled by pure kerosene. The batteries that ran the radio, actually there were two small radios that alternated. The battery were mail order. They bought them from they'd written away with a check and gotten it from a company in England. I mean, it was extremely low tech, and it was highly polished. And when the Russians made sure that they put the frequencies on bands that people could hear, and they also polished it like crazy so that we could see it, so that the certain at dawn and dusk the sun the which is beyond the horizon would reflect against it. We could see it. And we found out many years later, as a lot of us were actually seeing part of the rocket, the booster. But the fact remained, we were seeing a man-made object that night.
And that was apparently that was intentional on Mr. Korolev's part. The design, the aesthetics of it, the fact that he said, "Well, like other satellites, why don't we go ahead and make it round?" But it was also his idea to have this highly polished surface, so in fact it could be seen.
Right, and it was a ritualistic thing. I mean, they draped it in velvet and they polished it every night and before they went to bed. I mean, and I think those guys knew these guys, and of course the Russians had the geniuses who were there, which we couldn't even imagine them. They had gone through all of the purges of Stalin. I mean, Stalin had killed his most brilliant scientists because they were thinking impure thoughts or something. And so they had and Korolev had spent years in the Gulag, where he kept his rocket work alive. And finally, the moderates get in and bring him back into favor, and he's come back. They take him out of prison again. But you realize how these guys were really, really good. And if it hadn't been for the repressive horrible nature of the iron fist of Stalin, they would have even had probably even more great scientists at that time.
Yeah. Certainly the story that you tell really is a story of individuals and their contributions. And this man is interesting in part because he was somebody, as you say, that until he was dead, we didn't know about him. But he was certainly, I don't know if you would call him the father of the Soviet space program, but certainly was the man who was responsible for the three Sputnik launches and also for the trip of Yuri Gagarin into space. So this was an extremely important individual, this Sergei Korolev.
Yeah, and of course the Russians at that, I mean, the Cold War was raging, so everybody was worried about the other side. And one of the reasons the Russians kept him quiet was, or kept his name secret and for away from the West, was they were afraid that when if the West ever realized how important he was to what they were doing, that he would be killed, he would be assassinated by the CIA or somebody. So that was their worry. And of course, we were on the other hand, we couldn't figure it out. We didn't know who it was, and we originally we thought, well, maybe they got better German scientists than we did, but they didn't. And they actually got some, but they were not crucial. It was really this small crew under Korolev who had this real vision of what they could do. And of course, it is fascinating because when it went up, we had no idea. We were so insular and we were so dismissive of the Soviets at that point that the big joke, and it's not very funny because I don't expect you to laugh, but before Sputnik, there had been articles in Collier's magazine and other places about the Russians having these portable bombs, nuclear weapons, which they nicknamed suitcase bombs, and because they could be carried like a suitcase. And the joke in America was we didn't have to worry about the suitcase nuclear bomb from the Russians because they didn't have the technology to manufacture a suitcase. And that was funny up till Sputnik, and then it ceased to be funny because we realized these people are really quite competent and quite good. And we were confusing the shoddy consumer goods, the cars that weren't that great and the phones that didn't work with their resolve and their sort of desire to be progressive and move ahead.
Well, that was maybe understandably what we saw the public face of Soviet technology were those things. Those are the things that you, as an American, if you went to Moscow and walked down the street, that's the impression that you would get. But what you would not see would be all of this effort that was highly classified and highly secret that they were doing their best to make sure that we didn't know anything about.
But the other point was we didn't do our homework. I mean, we had really become insular. So, I mean, we didn't realize. I mean, they had translated. Our great scientist was Goddard, and the Germans had some great scientists, and the Russians had translated all of our stuff. But there was a great Soviet or Russian before he was there before the revolution. So it wasn't Soviet, but a great Russian theoretician named Tsiolkovsky, and he basically came up with some of the most fundamental theories and postulates of rocketry in the 19th century and into the 20th century. And when the Russian Revolution came along, they elevated him to a high level because they thought of themselves as potentially going into space very early after the revolution. And we didn't know, there were a few people, we hardly knew this guy ever existed. Yet he had some of the theories and some of the things that he developed are things which basically are the basis of rocketry. So we had so marginalized the Soviet people that we were in for this shock. I mean, there was one great example I found where Wernher von Braun, the former German engineer who had come over, we brought him over after the Third Reich had collapsed. General Gavin, who was the head of Army R&D, had gone to the Congress, to the Senate, and they were trying to tell the senators in a hearing that the Russians were about to go up with a satellite. And they were literally thrown out of the hearing room. I mean, Alan Ellender, who was the one senator who voted against NASA many years later, he said, "I've been to Russia. I've seen what these people, they can't tie their shoelaces. Get out of here." And they literally threw these guys. They were about to, almost citing them for contempt. They threw them out of the hearing room. Hmm. And that's how, and the other thing was I went back through all the clippings before Sputnik, and I found, and I probably missed some, but I found 25 references in the New York Times of the fact that the Soviets were trying to tell us they were going to put up a satellite.
Well, I'm going to call here, and I promise that person I won't make him wait forever. But just to make one further point, one of the things that you talk about in the book is, to the popular mind, the launch of Sputnik came as a big shock and a big surprise. It was not a shock and a surprise to the government of the United States.
Right. Nor the certain level of scientists. There were certain ones, but it was to the journalists weren't prepared. The mm-hmm. journalists some people have called it a media riot. There were some scientists who'd never been in the limelight before that sort of lost control and started making these wild predictions. And Congress, President Eisenhower, the CIA, there were certain people in power who were very much aware of what was going on. But to a large degree, the rest of us didn't want to know or we refused to look at the signs, the tea leaves that were very clearly out there.
Our guest this morning, Paul Dixon, he's a journalist and author. He's contributed articles to many magazines and papers. He's written more than 40 books. The one we're talking about here this morning, if you're interested in reading it, is titled Sputnik, The Shock of the Century. Walker & Company is the publisher. Should be out there in bookstores if you want to look at it. And questions, of course, are welcome. 333-9455. We also have toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. We have a couple of callers here. The first is in Charleston, line 4. Hello.
Hello. Thank you very much for taking my call. Maybe somewhat of a tangent here, but at least to me interesting. I happened to be in my undergraduate studies at the Urbana campus in the fall of 1957, taking an introductory astronomy course from Professor Stanley Wyatt. And it was just absolutely fascinating to be there and to have had that experience, a very unpredictable. And one thing I wanted to mention, that you just said that this had not been a shock to the government of the United States, and I would, to some extent, take issue with that because, at least if memory serves, the University of Illinois had an operational tracking station at that time, which, again, as this particularly memory, if memory serves here, was in operation at a time when our so-called Vanguard network was not yet online, which would indicate to me that at least somebody there was caught a little bit off guard, and it certainly offered an opportunity for students in our class and other personnel at the U of I to be in a very much of an advantaged position where others were basically not only able to sit around and read the newspapers about it, but in our case to actually participate in some of the tracking operations, logging transits in this particular case. So I thought I would just drop that in there.
Yes. See if, no, you're exactly correct. The people who actually did, because the Russians didn't go up on the Vanguard, the Vanguard network actually went up on October 1st. But that was set to the frequencies for the International Geophysical Year, which is what Vanguard was going up on, which we thought the Russians were going to use. But what we had in this country at that time had been put together by a very sort of, by a small group based in Cambridge at MIT and Harvard, was a group of amateurs who would track these things. And you know, academic, not just amateurs, but academic departments, other people who were not part of the official government business, but were part of just a tracking network. And so a lot of the people who made history, a lot of the people who fed the most important information back were people in small colleges and amateur astronomers and other people like that. So it was, but you're exactly right. I mean, places like the University of Illinois were crucial to figuring out what was going on, and so we could start doing our tracking. And of course, the tracking, the amazing thing was as soon as we started tracking and hearing the beep, the American mind sort of went into action, and that's when the group at Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Lab came up with the idea of using it for global positioning. So the first global positioning experiments, well, the ones that we now have in golf carts and in cars and things to tell us where we are on the face of the globe, that was begun within a couple of days of Sputnik going up.
I hope that gets at the question of the call. Let's go to an Indiana listener here, line number one. Hello.
Yes, I'd like to thank you for having the guest. It's a chance for me to revisit my college career, too. In 1957, I was a college freshman, and what I thought was most interesting, and your guest might comment on it, when the first satellite went up, I don't remember, it was probably 100, 150 pounds, something like that. It was very small, and everybody said, wow, that's great, but oh, it's little. Ours are going to be much bigger, and I believe within the next 6 to 8 months, the Russians put up their second satellite, and if I recall, it was around 1,100 pounds, and that really took us by surprise.
Well, you're right in the sense that the first one was 187 pounds, but that for us was huge because we thought, our scientists immediately thought that they'd misplaced a decimal point, and it was 1.87 pounds because our first satellite, which we were building, the Vanguard, was the size of a grapefruit, and that only weighed about 4 pounds. So we were thinking, well, the Russians could never get 187. The next thing the Russians put up, which was on in November of 57, a month later, a little bit more than a month later, was Sputnik 2, which had a dog in it and had a life support system. And the next one they put up in March of 58 was the size of a Lincoln Continental, of those, you know, replete with tail fins, which basically was a laboratory, an Earth-circling laboratory. So we were stunned. And, of course, when ours goes up, everybody's mocking ours. When we get the Vanguard up, which is really our second satellite, but it's the one we've been working on. And what people don't realize is that it's a perfect satellite. It's been miniaturized. We're using these new circuits. It's a powerful little thing. But Khrushchev says it's nothing more than a grapefruit, and everybody's making fun of us for this little satellite, when, in fact, the little satellite was really the most advanced of them all, because it incorporated this high sort of high level of technology that can only be achieved through miniaturization.
I want to go back again to this question of how much the United States knew about the Soviet effort, and in particular at the highest level, you know, say at the level of the president, Mr. Eisenhower, how much they knew about what the Russians were planning on doing.
Well, you've got to go back to 55, July 30th, 55. We announced that as part of the International Geophysical Year, which is a multinational attempt to sort of explore the universe or the our planet and the atmosphere and the close space near us. We announced that we were going to put up a satellite on July 30th, 1955. The next day, the Russians made the similar announcement. They said they, too, were going to put up a satellite. from that point on, the military and the government really took them seriously, and they kept an eye on it. They were watching it the whole time. We could have gone up. We could have gone up and beaten the Russians at any point after 55. And Wernher von Braun and the army had come to Eisenhower on five separate occasions and begged to let the United States put a satellite in orbit. And Eisenhower and the top people in the government said, absolutely not, we're not going to let it happen. And at one point in 56, in September of 1956, it is rumored that von Braun, the German engineer, Wernher von Braun, and General Medeiros, who was the head of the Army Missile Command, and several other people, were going to have an accident at Los Alamos. They were going to send up a rocket, and they're going to accidentally release the first stage and was going to go into orbit and be the first man-made satellite. Eisenhower hits the roof and actually sends people down from the White House to prevent this accident from happening. So all the way along, it's like a poker game. We know we've got the cards. We know we can go first. The United States, the highest level of government, knows that the Russians are probably going to beat us. Eisenhower says the only way we're going to go up is using a civilian satellite, which was the Vanguard. What Ike was afraid of, and this was his genius, and this is the crux of the story that I tell in the book. Ike was really concerned about nuclear war. Ike did not want the Third World War to happen. He did not want the United States and the rest of the world to be destroyed. So he, very early in administration, he went to Khrushchev and Bilgan in Geneva, earlier, actually in 55, and said, look, fellas, we really want to have open skies. We want to make sure we know where every one of your nuclear weapons is, and you can have access to our skies, and you can see where our nuclear weapons are. And they said, absolutely not, it's out of the question. At that moment, Ike started the highest level of secrecy to develop spy satellites, well before Sputnik. He was building spy satellites so that we could go up and look into the Soviet Union and see what was going on. When Sputnik goes up, Eisenhower is secretly pleased, even though it's an embarrassment to his administration and everybody criticizes him, because what had happened in one moment was, as soon as that Sputnik crossed the Mississippi, which it did every hour and a half, he knew that we'd established the principle of freedom of space, which meant if we didn't protest the Soviets or we didn't try to shoot it down or something else, they basically violated our airspace. So in part of Eisenhower's grand plan, we now had the upper hand in the sense that we now had permission to go and look and see where all those missiles were hidden. By the same token, Eisenhower, the battle behind the scenes is between Eisenhower and certain top people who want to keep space for the civilian, for communications, well, surveillance, which is really a way to prevent war, but, you know, for surveillance, for communications, for television, for all this stuff, which is peaceful, weather satellites and Earth, you know, looking at the Earth for developing our agriculture and such, versus the military, which wants it. The military really wants space as a weapons platform. And between Eisenhower and then later Johnson, who Ike sort of hands this off to, this fight for a civilian agency, and then Kennedy, we what we have is a civilian space program.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is author, journalist Paul Dixon. He has been, since 1968, a full-time freelance writer. He's contributed articles to many magazines and newspapers, just to mention a few, Smithsonian and The Nation and The New York Times and The L.A. Times. He's the author of more than 40 books. The one we're talking about here this morning is Sputnik, The Shock of the Century. It's published by Walker & Company, so it is out there in the bookstores if you'd like to read the story. And questions are also welcome from people who are listening. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. How is it that it is John Kennedy who's the one who says the United States is going to go and put a human being on the moon?
That's a good question, because I think initially, I actually found out where Kennedy was the night that Sputnik went up, and Kennedy and his brother, Robert Kennedy, actually stopped in a bar in Boston called Loch Ober and go in there for a late-night drink, and the bartender has become a big fan of space, very pro pro-space gets in an argument. And there's another professor from MIT there named Doc Draper. And John F. Kennedy makes this huge argument against space, saying it's a waste of time, a waste of money. He may have been just doing it to do a, you know, apparently the Kennedys often would take different sides of an issue just for the to be provocative and sort of get ideas on the table. But I think it grew on him. I think he really began to see something out there that wasn't self-evident. And I think one thing that was a catalyst, I think, was the Bay of Pigs. Kennedy went to the Congress to ask for the moon, the moon landing, shortly after the Bay of Pigs, when America's morale was very low and we weren't doing well in the world. But I think what happened, and I think this really dawned on Kennedy. I know it dawned on John McCormick, who was the Speaker of the House during those years, and actually wrote a book on this topic. What was increasingly perceived was this: that if we got into a battle with the Soviet Union over basically a huge contest, which would have real heroes and real expenditure of national, you know, wealth and, you know, huge effort and the whole business, that it was a phenomenally sort of useful surrogate to the nuclear war, where you spend all this money and then destroy each other and destroy the planet. But here was a way in which you could basically have this mammoth contest between superpowers that could show how brave and how smart they were, but there was a surrogate that was better than having the war. I mean, it's not even in the same category as having a war. And I think Kennedy, I know McCormick, one of the reasons, McCormick didn't really care about space. What he really cared about was preventing nuclear war. And I think I've never found it written by Kennedy, but I think that may have been part of his thinking, because other people at that time were thinking that way. And I think it may have accrued to some of the moderates in the Soviet Union, who were fighting their own sort of military right, who wanted basically to make everything of military confrontation. Whereas the Russians thought that they had a really good chance of beating us to the moon.
Hmm. Did he think, or did those people think much about everything else that would follow, technology spinoffs and so forth? Or was it mostly just the symbolic achievement of having that American set foot on the moon?
Yeah, I think they saw this big, much bigger picture. And I think it was evident early. I think there's a chapter in the book in which I talk about how Eisenhower gets involved very early in this. He picks 88 of the people he can most trust, and they put up their own satellite. He's really doing this to prove that he's being so beaten down by his own military, and everybody's attacking him in the post-Sputnik weeks, and he's had a stroke, and all these things are happening to him. But there's this one moment in 58 where he gets 88 people together and secretly puts up his own satellite with his own voice on it, which is in December of 58, in which he says, peace on earth, goodwill towards men, which is his message. I think what he's trying to do there, I think what he does, and he basically steals the space from the military at that moment, and they're furious. Von Braun, all these other the powerful people involved in space are marginalized. They're kept out of the picture. And Ike does this with some of his old buddies and the Army Signal Corps guys and, you know, a couple of friends of his in the Pentagon. I mean, literally like a bunch of guys decide they're going to go, you know, put up a satellite, except one of them is the President of the United States. And I think at that moment, I think as the line was drawn, that this country was going to do a lot better if it used all this technology for good and for communications and for et cetera, et cetera. Because here's, you know, Ike puts his voice on the satellite, and everybody in the world overnight saw the utility of this, you know, saw the idea that space could be this great place to bounce messages and bounce television images off of and radio, et cetera. And so I think early on they didn't know that it was going to give us cell phones and laptops and all the rest of it. But they did see, as soon as they saw that we'd have to re-engineer everything and make it miniature, all the computers, all the things that went into those spacecraft, both manned and unmanned, we're now reaping the harvest of that, because they had to re-engineer everything. They had to get rid of the vacuum tubes, make things, you know, circuits that could do 100,000 things no bigger than your thumbnail. And this was all part of that whole space thing. So I think it became evident to people as they went forward that there was going to be this harvest of other things that were going to come to us.
I'm sure that some people will know that, and as you explain in the book, that some of these folks who were the early rocketeers, that is the post-war rocketeers, came to the United States from Germany and had worked for the Nazis and designing V2s. And Werner von Braun was one of them, and you indeed tell the story in that he and they knew that the end was coming, that Germany had lost the war, and they asked themselves, who would we most want to be captured by? And engineered their, made it possible for them to come over to the United States. And a lot of very important rocket scientists then came to the United States and started developing rockets for this country. There also was a connection between the Nazi rocket program and the Soviet Union in the sense that, again, some people who had worked in the program then went to work for the Soviet Union, although we don't perhaps haven't given it that much attention because the people that we perceive as being the most important came to the United States, and yet the Soviets did manage to take advantage of what those scientists had learned in building rockets for the Nazis.
Yes. But I think we got far, far better into the deal. We got freight car after freight car of parts. Von Braun was a shrewd man, and he had basically all the plans. I mean, they were the top guys. I mean, Von Braun was the top man, and he brought all the top people, and they didn't want to be captured. They didn't want to go to Russia. They had been bombed. They'd been killing British people by in large numbers, civilians. They felt if the British got them, they would be tried as war criminals. If the French, they'd used a lot. They had factories in Peenemünde where they were building the V2 and the V1, and 20,000 prisoners died in those factories. They were fed 400 calories a day and they worked until they died of starvation. Von Braun and his people were very much aware of these people, and they felt the feeling was at that time that if the French had gotten them, they would have tried them as war criminals as well, because a lot of the people in those factories, besides Jews and other people who you would normally associate with the Holocaust and with what the Germans were doing to people, a lot of those people were the French resistance. They threw them so there were a lot of French dying in these prisons, or these work camps, they called them. They were underground, and they just die. And it was the first weapon system in history. I think the V2 killed 8,000, 20,000 died building it. So you had 20,000 people die, more people died making the weapon than did from the weapon itself, which is an extraordinary sort of equation when you think about it. So those guys they decided they would find the Americas. America was still fighting Japan, and they knew that America had basically disregarded its own geniuses in the rocket field. Goddard, who the Germans had learned a lot from, who was a little bit of a maverick, but America had never treated him with any great respect. And so they realized that they could now become the American rocket program. And the 120-odd came over, and we exempted them from all the rules and put them into a place where they could work with the V2s and develop the American rocket program.
We have a caller to talk with here in Champaign County. Let's do that. Line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, a lot of people starved because of all the potatoes that went into making the alcohol for the fuel for the V2. Well, so that was another blowback, and that's another whole story. It isn't germane, but people know that's a code word anyway. I wanted to talk about the blowback of the Sputnik on the academic community. There was, I think, at least a doctoral thesis at the Education Policy Studies Institute at U of I. I don't know if it was ever made a book. It seems like it should be, and maybe you do have some reference to this that we haven't gotten to talking about yet, is how it affected the curriculums in academia, the schools. I watched it, and I was right on the cusp, so I saw the pre-chem study, BCCS, the old post-Sputnik educational things, and then I saw the earlier ones, too, from older relatives, and the transformation was pretty phenomenal. The older ones had a lot of industrial examples, particularly in chemistry, and the newer ones, post-Sputnik, were all sort of designed to foster research scientists. I mean, and I think it's important for academia to do research, but it seems to have a sort of an unanticipated effect of isolating the scientific community from on the ground, real life industrial things, and I think that has had a bad effect.
Yeah,
I have a comment on that. I have another point too. So.
Sure. You want to do that first, or let's do that first because you hit on a fascinating subject, which very few people, I mean, everybody knows it had a phenomenal effect on curriculum reform. You know, my short form for younger students was that we went from Dick and Jane to Dr. Seuss almost overnight. We started making our kids think. We were educating more women, et cetera, et cetera. And the effect on curriculum was, you know, it fundamentally killed Latin and Greek as a high school science, you know, subject, and we were having language labs. But the impact on education was monumental and still being felt. But what the point you're driving at, which was the unintended negative effect, has been documented in several books, including a book by Ernest Eugene Ferguson from Johns Hopkins, which he makes the point that we became so theoretical after Sputnik that we couldn't we're starting to take kids in engineering school that had never been tinkerers and never played around with cars, and that we were designing things like that Hartford Convention Center that collapsed under the weight of wet snow because it was designed on a mathematical model based on where they didn't make the snow heavy enough. And so he was claiming that we lost that sort of down-to-earth, practical kind of engineering and science which we had experienced beforehand, and we were now going to a new kind of level of science that was so theoretical that it often backfired. And he uses examples right up through some of the Martian misplacing of decimal points on the Martian, unmanned Martian. So you make an interesting point, and very few people ever talk about the negative effects. The other effect that I would question was a large part of the Sputnik reform in secondary education was really intended for the talented and gifted of the time, and that that a lot of people sort of got left behind. They were driving trade subjects out of high schools. You couldn't have a course in auto mechanics in an academic high school anymore after Sputnik. And it sort of marginalized that second half of the class, or the lower half, and that may have been a deleterious thing.
That was more like the bottom 80%, if I recall.
Yeah.
It might have been different places.
Yeah.
The other point is the kind of mad fancy that the space era all engendered. There's a great early book called Arming the Heavens by a guy out of the Syracuse peace community. This documents all of the incredible fantasy life of basically Pentagon types about what, you know, war in space was going to be like and how it was going to give us full spectrum dominance, and that it was, you know, and that really, I think, was formative for like people like Rumsfeld who do the Space Commission. We do have a peaceful use of space treaty that hasn't been talked about much that will also be abrogated if we go ahead with the kind of things that are being talked about. I think that's part of the blowback too, but it is mainly another story, which I'm sure this call-in show will return to on another day.
Once again, you bring up something that's fascinating to me, because actually you use the word Pentagon, which has become a code word for the highest level of people. I think what was happening back in the 50s was that there were some of the real cerebral people in the Pentagon actually wanted the Secretary of Defense level, McElroy and others, really wanted was civilian space. Just like before that, the Pentagon lost the fight for atomic energy. In other words, the Pentagon wanted control of all things nuclear, and they lost it. And they lost it to the Atomic Energy Commission was formed in its stead. What happened with space was, I think that the real people who wanted to do this war in space, and some of the stuff is unbelievable. You go look back at the old Life magazines from that era, and they were talking about using rockets. You know, you go into space or orbit the Earth once and then land a whole platoon of men in a foreign country. And they would be armed. They'd jump out of this nose cone and you know, start shooting people. I mean, they were envisioning all these bizarre and huge stations in space with all sorts of laser guns and missiles, and they could, you know, any insurrection in some small republic would be brought under control in a matter of minutes. And this kind of stuff was going on. And I think, again, you know, the fear is, and Ike saw this. I mean, Eisenhower saw this. He saw that had we just couldn't go that way. It just was going to be the devastating thing. And I think that every once in a while that monster raises its head.
This is my last comment. The author Jack Hanna, whose name comes to me of the book I mentioned, Arming the Heavens, had a later article that talked about the upsizing of the space shuttle for exactly that kind of military mission of taking troops to a different place on the Earth in a hurry. And he actually says that upsizing was unnecessary for other uses of space, that peaceful uses, that you don't really need to take the cargo on the same vessel that the people go up on. You can dock in space, whereas and he says that's one of the reasons why it's more dangerous than it should be. But I'll let that hang in the air and listen to the rest of your show. Thanks a lot.
All right, thank you. Let's go on. Here we have another caller in Urbana. They're next, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, two things. I understood that when Sputnik went up, and you were referring to the beeping sound that you got from it, that people realized that if they put a clock up there, it would be really useful for your navigation. It's a little bit like the idea of that recent book about, I think his name was Harrison, the fellow who developed a clock, a chronometer that would work on ocean-going vessels.
Mm-hmm.
Is that if you can just set up a satellite, then all you have to do is listen to the time, the exact time, according to the satellite. Whatever happened with that?
You know, you stumped me on that. I don't know the answer. But the thing I do know is that it was, in fact, the beep itself, which had a little bit of telemetry in it, but it was, for all intents and purposes, it was meaningless. That the beep itself was a boon to science because they, as I think we've already mentioned, the global positioning people realized that navigation would never be the same because we knew the thing was going to be at every moment so that we could track that. So, but I'm unaware of the business with the clock in space.
Yeah, I heard that replacing that beep with a time, you know, like we've got nowadays.
Yeah.
But the other question is, and I'll hang up for this one, is it just seems to me, I mean, I was really affected by Sputnik. I named my first dog Sputnik, which was, luckily we lived out in the country. But it seems like, talking a little bit close to what the last caller was talking about, that the Star Wars initiative is threshold event, but not so much. Only we're on the kind of playing the Russians here, and the rest of the world is playing the people watching this weapons platform develop over their heads. And I was just curious if you had any thoughts along those lines, and I'll hang up. Thanks.
Yeah, you know, again, it's I'm going to be brave here and say that I'm just really not that qualified to discuss Star Wars because I'm still not sure I know exactly what is true and what isn't. I still go back to a theory that several people I've talked to, that a lot of what we did with during the Reagan years with Star Wars was a bluff, that we just didn't really have the technology. There were a lot of it was, again, going back to the poker game. We would show some films in front of a congressional committee and say, here's how great this thing works, and are the assumption being that it would go back to the Soviet Union. They say, well, we can't match this, and that it was, a lot of it was a bluff. It'll be years before all that stuff becomes declassified, and we'll know what is true and what isn't. So I'm going to back off for a minute because I just don't know the answers there.
We're coming down to the point where we maybe have a minute or two left, and we talked a little bit about Sputnik and politics and technology. Would you talk for a little bit about the impact of Sputnik on popular culture?
Well, it was everywhere. I mean, I'm looking at a tape that a friend of mine made called Sputnik Rock and Roll. I mean, all of a sudden it was in music and it was in books and it was, I mean, my favorite example of somebody who was affected in the arts was Stephen King. It was an 11-year-old kid in a movie theater in Stratford, Connecticut, and they were watching one of these films called The Earth versus Flying Saucers, one of those old movies where these Martians come down and immediately, you know, abscond with women from the beaches of Santa Monica who were dressed in bikinis, I mean, that kind of movie. And in the middle of this movie, the theater owner runs in and turns on the lights and said, "Boys and girls, the rockets, the Russians have put a rocket in space. God save America." And King says that this, for him, for days he worries that there are actually bombs up there. They're going to drop it on his house, and that he becomes. He said that's the beginning of the dread. That's the beginning of what made Stephen King. So it's all different things like that. The other thing, of course, it was after Sputnik, we started spending money on even on the arts, even on educating people in other. We started upgrading everybody's education. But there was a lot more money to send a kid who couldn't afford to go to a top school or an engineering school. They have only been able to afford to go to a trade school. The government started handing out money. So a lot of people, they didn't have to do it in science. They could do it in painting or something. So we really did sort of ratchet up everything after Sputnik.
Well, we can leave it at that. We're here at the end of the time. We want to say, Mr. Dixon, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much.
Our guest, Paul Dixon. He's journalist, author, and if you'd like to read the book that we have been talking about, the title is Sputnik, The Shock of the Century. It's published by Walker & Company and is available now in the bookstores.